Hello, this is your guest host, Andy Smerick of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, filling in for Mike Petrilli, who's away again on vacation. We're here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the intrepid journalist, formerly held captive, but released yesterday thanks to former President Bill Clinton, Rick Hess.
Hey, and I do owe Billy Bob a big one, man, I'll tell you.
What does it say that they sent him instead of his wife to do this? I'm kind of confused.
Maybe, you know, we might be that we don't really want the U.S. Secretary of State kind of bending their knee before the crazy boy.
But it's better to send a former president of the United States than bend his knee?
Yeah, that part I didn't quite get. But I was kind of glad that they insulated the secretary from it.
So what did...
They could have sent Duncan. He likes to talk to people.
That's true. That's great. All right, well, let's not talk anymore about North Korea. Let's get going on this.
Let's talk about North Korean schools for a moment.
Do you know anything about North Korean schools?
No, not a lot.
Do they have schools in North Korea?
They do. We know for a fact they do. They don't. Surveillance has established that.
They don't partake in any international assessment. Though, do they? So we can't say anything about the quality?
I think that's a safe bet.
Okay, maybe that topic will come up later. But first, we're going to do Pardon the Gadfly with Mickey, and then Amber will edify us with the Research Minute. And then finally, Stafford will do Rate That Reform. So I guess it's time to go. Mickey, want to kick us off?
Okay, sure. Question one. This week, the New York Times hosted this debate about the value of school tests, I think specifically in New York. Questioning what they measure and whether what they measure is valuable or not. Is this an important debate to be having, and is it time to reconsider tests and our focus especially on standardized tests?
Oof, you could tell we're on summer here. We are not, and we could tell that we're still breaking in the new crew. Not as crisp quite as that the old Christina Hentges kind of moderated operation. We got it. We're going to pick it up, though.
She set a high bar.
She did. But, Mick, we'll get your precision down, baby.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the patience.
what's the answer here, Andy?
Well, so it seems like we're almost retrenching. For a while, everyone believed that assessments were the way to go, and now it seems like there's this reconsideration going on. And Petrilli, as you know, it seems like any time great test scores come out, his automatic reaction is, well, we have to be skeptical about this. People are teaching to the test, or it just means narrowing the curriculum, or on and on and on. So I'm not part of that camp yet. I think that I'm old school about this, actually, like late 1990s old school. I think that the federal government and states provide well over $500 billion to schools, and it's important to figure out what kids know in basic subjects. And yes, all of these issues about where cut scores are important, but are we really thinking about degrading the value of figuring out what kids learn, and especially the subgroups learn? So I'm not in the take a new look, whole new look at state assessments camp.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue here with the assessments is what assessments are designed to do is assess something, which is right, how much kids are learning in terms of skills or knowledge that we mm-hmm. want them to master. The problem is that, right, Dan Koretz has done the terrific work on this, obviously, over the years, along with a bevy of others, that when we use these repeated administrations of state assessment regimes, that what happens is everybody learns what domains are getting assessed, everybody learns the question formats, and so what you see is this predictable march up the incline. And what's happened, as with in so much else in education, because we don't believe in just doing what we're doing well or better, we believe in saving a generation of kids this week, that we predictably massively overshot the target with the push for accountability and for assessment. And we have therefore wound up with a raft of crude assessments, poorly configured, with too much weight placed upon them. And rather than a sensible appreciation for the way that we can use these, kind of the role that Nate plays, mm-hmm. what we have done is we have actually just stacked too many bricks on the cart. And so what we see in situations like New York and D.C. Is, you know, real discomfort when trying to figure out how much confidence we can have and what the results mean.
I think that's interesting, and the thing I'm most fascinated about, because I'm skeptical about the march towards national assessments or common assessments and standards, is none of the problems that you just laid out would go away. They might even get worse.
That's
if we have national tests or national standards.
Yeah, that's a real risk.
I'll take that up with Petrilli later on. Issue two?
Okay, question two. Last week, Rick, you and Mike Petrilli co-wrote an Education Gadfly article critical of the Race to the Top Fund. Rick, please explain your point, and Andy, why don't you comment on it when you're done?
For those folks who checked out the piece in the Gadfly, what they saw was Mike and I arguing that we're deeply concerned that with Race to the Top, the administration is at risk of doing to charter schooling, to data systems, to turnarounds, what the Bush administration did to accountability. And that was not intended as a compliment. The concern is that it's actually exactly the point we just hit in terms of assessment systems. And that in the in their enthusiasm to take what Mike and I regard as really useful and important ideas and to supersize them and to take them from boutique status to Walmart status in the space of about 24 months, that exorbitant and extravagant claims are being made, that a lack of appreciation for how one actually does these things well is being exhibited, and that what we're setting ourselves up for is exactly what we saw in the earlier part of this decade, when a broad and, you know, slowly and painfully established consensus on the value of accountability, which initially responded to NCLB with great enthusiasm, unraveled over the next 2 or 3 years, and what we wound up with was a once broadly supported idea becoming actually controversial and, in fact, being fragmented when too much weight was placed upon it too early. And I think that's, you know, that's very much my concern with how Race to the Top is shaping up.
I think it's an interesting analysis. The one difference, I think, between NCLB and Race to the Top, of course, is one is absolutely mandatory, and the other one, to the extent that states can get by without getting a share of the $4.35 billion, is discretionary. States don't have to do this stuff if they don't want to. But Rick and Mike's point, I think, the fundamental one, is an interesting one, which is what really bothers me or worries me is the administration seems so darn certain, as we've been certain over the past 5, 10, 15, 40 years, about the reform du jour is going to solve all of the problems. So they've decided that if we just do data systems, if we just do teacher quality, if we just do charters, therefore schools are going to be completely solved. Therefore, they have these 19 things, and states have to respond to every single one of them and do exactly what the federal government wants. I believe in all of those things. I think they're good, but a little bit more humility on this front, I think, is called for.
That's right. And the key here is that there's a huge difference, right? Doing something like desegregating schools is something the feds can actually go out and count.
Mm-hmm.
When we're saying doing turnarounds or doing charter schools, 99% of this is in the execution. 1% of this is in the enabling legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what worries me in particular is that Race to the Top is not a handful of states showing that they are creatively solving problems. It's going to be a bunch of states showing that they have enacted enabling legislation.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say about this is I get worried because imagine if all the states do precisely what the federal government wants. They could have great charter laws. They could have great data systems. They could have great teacher compensation systems. You could have all those things and still have a huge achievement gap. You could still have failing schools. You could still have big problems. Those things, by no stretch of the imagination, necessarily lead to the types of things that we're looking for. Humility is called for. Issue three.
All right. Issue three. The KIPP school in Baltimore was in the news recently because the local teachers union intervened and wanted teachers' salaries to go up commensurate with the extra hours that they were working at the school, and as a result the school had to lay off and reduce hours. So the question is, are unions going to be continue to be more involved in intervening with charter affairs, and number two, what is this, if so, what is this going to look like? Does the Steve Barr Green Dot initiative working somewhat more collaboratively with between unions and charters provide some kind of promise for the future?
I mean, I think inevitably unions are going to be more engaged in charter schooling. We saw this earlier in the year in New York. Remember, charter schools today still only enroll, 1 to 2% of mm-hmm. American students. As those numbers continue to grow, unions have every incentive to get in there and become more active and more aggressive about organizing these schools. Steve Barr's approach is one possibility. It's a proactive strategy in which the fact that unions are going to enter that space is understood, and it's one particular way for trying to bend that curve. Whether that is a good and promising long-term strategy is unclear. You can make a smart argument either way. But I do think that is exactly the kind of thinking that's going to be increasingly necessary, that members of the charter community are going to have to think about how do they address the increasing incursion of unions, what kinds of strategies make sense, and how are they going to execute in this changing environment.
So the thing about this story that is so alarming is just the gall, like the chutzpah of what the teachers union did in Baltimore. I mean, this is really quite shocking. Just to take a step back, Ujima Village is a KIPP school in Baltimore. Not only was the highest performing school in math in the city of Baltimore, in a couple grades, it was the highest scoring school in the state. It was just phenomenal, and just this one lonely campus. And for years, it's been extraordinary. And the union actually came in and forced them to do some things that made them lay off six teachers, completely get rid of the positions, and get rid of Saturday school, which is a critical part of the model. And so the two pieces I want people to put together here are the fact that unions are getting increasingly involved in these schools, and this is what the face of increased unionization of these schools could look like. A lot of us who've been charter advocates have been a bit agnostic or ambivalent. Okay, unions are going to get involved, but they're not going to really attack the Amistads or the KIPPs or the uncommon schools. They're not going to want to mess with success. This was a real eye-opener for me. They are attacking success here.
Well, and but we should be careful, right? Because the union isn't doing this. It is the members of the school, the teachers at the school, who opted to join the union.
Actually, that's not the case. In Maryland, the law requires that all teachers are members of the collective bargaining agreement in the district.
Really?
That's right. So they have no choice at all. So they're actually paying dues to an organization that's doing to them things that they don't want to have done.
Well, that's fascinating.
Tragic. So this is probably the cutting edge, or hopefully the worst edge, of what this might look like. But what was arguably the best school in Maryland serving low-income kids is in trouble. Mm. All right, on that very happy note, I think it's time for us to move on. Amber, welcome. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm happy.
Good. So, unlike Mike, I'm not going to look at my watch and time you, but
I will.
Thank you.
60 seconds, Amps.
All right, babe.
All right.
So, and unlike Mike, I take the music out. 52 seconds.
I better start with the music right quickly.
Nah, I'm just teasing it.
All right, we have a study out this week from the Center on Reinventing Public Education that includes a state-by-state analysis of teacher compensation for master's degrees. We know that master's degrees in education bear no relation to student achievement, yet 90% of teachers' master's degrees are in education. We also know that teachers get a nice bump in salary from having them. This no doubt led to the education master's having the highest growth of all types of master's degrees in the last 10 years. The study found that Georgia, Nebraska, New York, and Washington are among the states that pay teachers the most for having master's degrees. Georgia, for instance, pays teachers an average of $8,300 more for having a master's compared to having a bachelor's. States that pay the least include Louisiana, Maine, and Texas. Texas, for instance, pays just over $1,400 for a master's. Importantly, the study only examines salary bumps, not what districts spend on reimbursing teachers for tuition costs. So the total expenditures are actually underestimated. It's also important to keep in mind that many states require teachers to have master's degrees for certain types of licenses, and many universities make it really easy for their students to graduate with a master's because of five-year programs. So lots of incentives to obtain master's degrees. Finally, researchers have a couple recommendations, one of which is to stop offering the salary increases for new teachers. Easier said than done.
And this is one more report out of Marguerite Rosas.
It is. Quick turnaround. It was maybe four or five pages, but very useful information.
Rick, can I ask you a question? This is about the history of this business. When did we begin, or the education establishment, assume that getting master's degree was necessarily the link to higher student performance? When did 60s, 70s, 80s?
No. In fact, it wasn't. And in fact, nobody ever assumed that there was a demonstrable link. This is actually very much part of the progressive era. The notion that, look, we didn't have any other way to judge whether schools were doing their work well. Mm-hmm. We were importing Taylorism, right? Scientific management in the early part of the 20th century, which was a notion that we are going to systematize education, just like we've systematized business. And what you want systematizes by coming up with neat flowcharts and grids where people are treated based on objective criteria. And a clear objective criteria, especially when somebody like Elwood Cubberley was dean at the Stanford School of Education, mm-hmm. was whether or not one had studied and received a credential from a school of education. So this, you know, the roots of this really go back close to a century.
You know, this is really interesting because if you were to read the guidance for the Race to the Top, it's conspicuous how the federal government, the Department of Education, didn't take on the issue at all of collective bargaining agreements. Mm-hmm. It's as though the entire teacher pay, teacher compensation, teacher evaluation exists in the netherworld out there completely unhinged from collective bargaining agreements. So you can actually see that there's this incentive to layer on and not mm-hmm. go back and look at the fundamentals that are leading to these problems. Maybe that's just a bargain that the Department of Education figured they had to make. Mm-hmm. More layering, I guess. All right. So tell us about the song.
All right. Since states are paying money for nothing, ooh. We have a song of the same name by Dire Straits. Don't we love this song?
Oh, take me back.
I have fond memories of the early days of MTV watching this video. Yeah, this was cutting edge video.
The fat guy and the skinny guy.
Yeah, and Laura, our media manager, had never heard of it. Can I just tell you?
Are you kidding me, Laura?
I know it.
I'm thinking, is she that much younger than me?
Well,
come on.
Yeah, did you know this one?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Remember the cartoon? That was such a great video.
Yeah.
What was that, like 86?
Exciting stuff. Yeah, that's about right.
Oof, sophomore year in college.
Good stuff.
So to pull the curtain back just for a second, Rick referenced a young woman named Olivia who is new to the Rick team. Do you want to say 15 seconds about your new teammate?
Yes. Olivia is my new teammate.
Welcome, <buddy.
laughs> You have 10 seconds left.
Oh, sweet. Olivia Meeks, Truman Scholar, proud University of Arkansas grad. Go Razorbacks.
That's right. I have a Razorbacks hat. It's my favorite hat. That's about all I can say about the University
Pat
of Arkansas.
Pat Wolf tends to do that. Every so often, you get a beer or two of him, and he'll start doing the suey. Hey, Pat, if you're listening to Babe, there's for you.
All right, Stafford, welcome. You're going to do Rate That Reform for us. Did you choose the song, or is this something that I chose for you?
I did choose it. It is the intro to another song.
What's the other song?
I actually don't remember, Laura.
Okay, let's make the magic happen.
Moving right along. Okay, so one might think that teaching kids how to cheat and encouraging obesity at the same time would be a difficult task, but not for this gym teacher from Kentucky, Michael Wilson, who obviously believes that that state needs to uphold its top 10 ranking in American obesity rates. He's been collecting $3 per gym period from students as a quote-unquote no running fee. In other words, if they pay, they don't have to participate, or get their heart rate up, or break a sweat, or work off all the ho-hos they ate for lunch. The teacher says that he was going to use the cash to support the girls' basketball team, but the school found about $1,000 in cash in his desk. And the payments also helped the kids get an easy gym class A. He's now on administrative leave. So grading this is all dependent on what you identify as the problem. Is it that the girls' basketball team is poor? Or is it that the teacher is poor and wants to make an extra buck? Or is it that some students are just uncoordinated and the gym teacher is trying to save the embarrassment in front of their classmates? Or is it that some students have lousy GPAs and he wanted to give them an easy A in the goodness of his own heart and maybe make an extra few bucks on the side? The answer is unclear. But I have to admit that I thought this scenario was pretty funny and rather ingenious on the teacher's part if you discount the damage to the psyche and physiques of his students. But it's summer, so I'm going to give it a gentleman's C.
Rick, what do you think here?
I think this helps make the case for a PE through the virtual school approach.
Oh, like Wii PE? Could we have Wii PE?
Wii PE. Actually, I've heard, I don't know if this is accurate or not, that through Florida Virtual School, that the most heavily subscribed course is physical education.
How does that work exactly?
I think you have to sign on at one. So one, this has been told to me. I can't confirm that this is actually accurate. My understanding is that what you do is it's frequently kids who have mono or ill in some fashion, and so what they do is they have to take the weekly quizzes and they have to certify that they have done their push-ups and their sit-ups and gone for walks, and seems like a generally sweet deal.
It does. I mean, it's something I'd never thought. A classic way to game the system. I mean, if you don't want to do gym, take it online. promise that you've done all your exercises and get some credit. Brilliant.
It, you know, it's all pretty straightforward.
Or you can just pay off your teacher and get an A anyway.
So I've noticed Rate the Reform has just moved towards picking on teachers who do really dumb things. Is this
a
trend?
Well, it's the middle of the summer, so schools are not making reforms right now.
All right. This may be a lot of depressing news here. Rick, any final words before we cut off?
No.
Well, very good. All right, everyone, thanks for joining us. Make sure to read the original Gadfly at edexcellence.net. Check out Flypaper, the blog, as well. So till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Andy Smerick. Thanks for joining us.